Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm Janet Hutchings, Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's editor. Dave Zelserman is probably best known to EQMM readers as the author of the Julius Katz and Archie series, which was inspired by the novels of Rex Stout. One of those stories, Archie's Been Framed, won the EQMM Readers Award in 2010. But the Boston author was already a rising star of hard-boiled and noir fiction before he created the tie-clip-sized computer Archie and his gourmet boss. Here he is reading one of his darker tales, Some People Deserve to Die, from the August 2011 issue of EQMM.
Dr. Jerry Hurst was fitting a temporary crown over my root canal when I received a call about the murder. With my mouth filled with clamps and other dental instruments, all I could do was grunt back a response to the precinct captain. He wasn't particularly amused at my predicament, and rather sourly gave me the address where the body was found, telling me to go over there as soon as I could, which meant he wanted me there a half hour ago. I sat impatiently for the next 10 minutes while Dr. Hurst removed the clamps and other junk from my mouth and wrote me out a prescription for Percocet. For the time being, I was numbed out enough with Novocaine that the prescription could wait. I drove straight to the murder site, the third level of a parking garage near Kendall Square. My partner, Joe Sullivan, was already there, as was our crime scene specialist and two of his interns. The crime scene specialist stopped what he was doing to nod to me, then continued taking pictures of the area. Joe and the interns were standing by an older model Honda Civic. Joe was in his late 30s, a big burly man with a scarred face and a flattened nose from his amateur boxing days. Joe Red Sullivan, at one time the pride of South Boston, although he had lost most of his reddish sandy hair since partnering with me, so his old nickname didn't quite fit anymore. From the neighborhood Joe came from, he could have easily turned criminal, but he went the other way and now had 14 years of service in. Me, I had 26 years. In another 4, if things went as planned, I'd be leaving Massachusetts and these lousy winters far behind me to buy a bar in Key Biscayne after I had my 30-year pension. As I approached them, I spotted the body lying on the ground beyond the Honda. Male, late 20s, maybe early 30s. Thin, medium height, dark complexion, probably of Indian descent, wearing worn jeans, a stained polo shirt, and dirty sneakers. The front part of his skull had been caved in above his right eye, and a small puddle of blood had pooled by his head. I tried asking Joe what they had, but because of the damn Novocaine, my speech came out slurred. That brought a hard grin for my partner. I knew he'd be in a rotten mood. He'd been talking all week about going to the Bruins game tonight, and with the murder, he now had little chance of being able to use his tickets. "Started drinking early today, huh, Steve?" he asked, an eyebrow arched innocently. He knew I had a 2 o'clock appointment with my endodontist, and further, that for the last 2 weeks, since a lower molar of mine had abscessed, the pain from it had me popping Advil every hour. It had been as if nails were being hammered into my jaw. No relief, not for a second. The last few days while waiting for my appointment, I had fantasized about pulling the damn thing out myself with a pair of pliers. Now the numbness I was experiencing was a godsend. I gave him a long, cold look. If my lower lip had had any life in it, I would have wished for him to experience the joy of an abscess and the accompanying root canal. But if I tried slowing that, I would have only cracked him up. So instead, I ignored his comment and kept up with the silent treatment. After a minute of that, his grin faded. "You look like hell, Steve," he said. "Lousy timing for a murder, huh? Root canal go okay?" "Yeah, I feel like a million," I said, talking like a ventriloquist with palsy. "What do we got?" Joe nodded towards the dead body. "Victim is one Sanjay Patel. The Honda Civic he's next to is registered to him. According to a work badge found on his person, he's employed at a software company on Broadway, about 2 blocks from here. Can't say for sure until the ME examines him, but it looks like the cause of death was the blow he took to the temple. From the dent in his skull, he was whacked pretty good. Nothing else that's visible. One blow? That would be my guess." I squinted at the body. The damage to the skull looked extensive. If that was done by a single blow, Whoever did it put a lot of muscle behind it. I shifted my gaze back to my partner. Emmy's on the way? Joe nodded, chewing on his bottom lip impatiently. Yeah, call was put in over a half hour ago. He should have been here already. While Cambridge is home to two major universities and is as congested as any urban setting, we don't get enough murders to justify having our own medical examiner, usually only one or two a year, so we rent out Boston's when we need the help. Joe, you might as well forget those hockey tickets. You're not going to be using them tonight. My partner glared at me for a moment before nodding glumly. I noticed a tire iron that had been placed in a plastic evidence bag. There was something brownish caked on it. Already knowing the answer, I asked if that was the murder weapon. Yeah, looks like it. It was left next to the body. Joe paused for a moment to run a hand through the little hair he had left on his head. It also looks like it was taken out of the victim's car. The tire irons for the same model Honda Civic, and the one that should have been in the trunk is missing. Steve, this wasn't a robbery. Money and credit cards were left in the victim's wallet. I don't think anything was taken. I gave the car another look. The windows were intact, as was the trunk. Whoever did this probably used a Slim Jim to unlock the front door, then pressed the trunk's release to get at the tire iron. I asked one of the interns if they'd taken fingerprints off the car yet. She told me they had. I turned to Joe and asked if he could open the trunk. He fished a set of keys from an evidence bag and pressed the remote button to pop the trunk open. The spare had been put back in place. "This the way you found it?" I asked. "Yep." I studied the inside of the trunk, noting how neat and orderly it appeared. This was looking more and more like a professional job. Someone taking their time to remove the tire iron from under the spare, then putting everything back in order and waiting for the victim so he could kill him with one well-placed blow. An amateur would have left the trunk in disarray, and probably also would have hit the body a half dozen more times before being satisfied that the man was dead. This was someone with ice water in his veins, someone who knew exactly what he was doing. I closed the trunk and felt a tightness contracting my stomach as I realized what we were up against. It was bad enough to have a murder in the city, but having one that you weren't going to be able to solve was far worse. And if the killer was as professional as he appeared, I doubted we were going to be able to solve it, at least not without a lucky break. A winning the lottery type lucky break. I asked Joe who found the body. Patrolman Winston. Joe's lids lowered halfway, giving him a tired, washed-out look. Routine drive-through after last week's briefing. He spotted the body. There had been a rash of car thefts the last few weeks from several of the garages around Central Square, and we were having patrolmen do some routine drive-throughs hoping to discourage it. If we had been able to get the garages to put security cameras up instead, this murder would have had a good chance of already being solved. Patrolman Lou Winston was standing about 100 feet away, staring stone-faced at us. I waved him over and asked whether he saw anyone. He didn't. So far, no witnesses either, which was about what I expected. The only thing he was able to tell me was that he found the body at 318. I let him go back to stand vigil. "What do you want to do?" Joe asked, again pushing a hand through his sparse hair. "Wait for the ME? No reason to. We can see him later. Let's go talk to some of Patel's co-workers." The murdered man's boss acted at first as if we were pulling a gag on him. When it finally dawned on him that this was no joke, the color drained from his face, leaving it a sickly white, and I thought for a moment he was going to pass out on us. He collected himself, though, and a little color came back, peppering his cheeks. He had no idea what time Patel left the office or why. "Sanjay was very quiet," he said. "He mostly kept to himself." "Any problems with co-workers?" Joe asked. He was shaking his head, but paused midway and shifted his gaze back to us. Still looking dazed, he told us how Patel was going through a divorce. "The little I've heard, it was pretty ugly," he said. Joe snuck me a look. An ugly divorce? That would explain a professional being involved. We talked some more, but other than that Patel had been working there for 3 years, we got nothing else from him. After that, we talked with everyone else in the office. Some of them were shocked to hear about a co-worker being murdered. Others didn't seem to care one way or the other. But the one thing they all had in common was that none of them had any personal relationship with Patel. We kept hearing the same comments about how Patel was quiet and kept to himself. A few of those who sat near him had overheard recent conversations he had with his lawyer and were able to piece together that he had been going through a heated and very contentious divorce. One of his co-workers remembered seeing him red-faced and stewing after one of these conversations. When the co-worker, alarmed, asked him what was wrong, Patel had muttered something about how his wife wasn't going to get a penny before turning back to his work. The only other thing we got was from the software developer who sat across from Patel, who remembered seeing him leave around 2:30. Before we left, Patel's boss was able to give us the last contact number he had for the dead man's wife. He let us use a speakerphone in one of their conference rooms. It turned out the number was for her cell phone, and she was at work at an accounting firm in downtown Boston. She sounded surprised to hear from us. When she asked why we were calling, we told her it would be better if we explained in person. She complained that she needed to leave work soon, but Joe warned her that it would be better if she stayed put until we got there, then hung up. We had a cell phone that Joe had found on Patel's belt. Most of the outgoing calls were for the same number, and when Joe tried it, he ended up reaching Patel's lawyer. Joe talked for a while, then hung up and told me how quickly the guy's attitude changed after he found out that his client was dead. "He seemed pretty pissed off," Joe said, his eyes glistening with amusement, a smirk hardening his lips. "I guess Patel owes him a bundle in fees, money he's now got a prayer's chance in hell of ever seeing." "He's going to make himself available to us?" I asked. "Yep. He works on Tremont Street near Park Station. He's going to hang around and meet us at the Parker House after we talk to the widow." I nodded. It was already past 5. Some feeling had come back to my lower lip. It was sore, kind of a dull ache, but nowhere near the excruciating pain I'd been suffering before the root canal. With some luck, I wouldn't have to be popping Percocet over the next few days. Anyway, it was a relief to have that tooth dead and the pain gone. I opened my mouth wide and moved my jaw from side to side, feeling as if I'd be able to talk normally. At least I'd no longer look as if I was in the middle of having a stroke. It was 5:20 before I was able to navigate through Boston traffic and park in front of the building where the widow worked. She was waiting for us in the accounting firm's lobby, a small, thin woman with unbelievably dark eyes. She reminded me of a wounded bird, a sparrow, and she might have been attractive if her face weren't so tense and anxious. She stared from Joe to me, fear mixing in with the anxiety. "I was supposed to leave a half hour ago to pick up my son," she said, trying hard to force some anger in her voice. "He's at daycare now, and they'll be charging me extra for this. What lies are my husband saying about me?" "Excuse me?" I asked, trying hard to look sympathetic, while at the same time sizing her up. The odds were she was the one who put a pro on her husband. Along with the fake show of anger, there was plenty of fear in her face. I decided to play it straight. "Your husband was found murdered in a parking garage near where he worked. That's why we're here." She blinked at me several times, her eyes turning glassy, and then she stumbled backwards until she could sit down. She reached blindly behind to feel for the chair. "Oh my God," she muttered, mostly to herself. She seemed in shock. But then again, even if it was genuine, it could be nothing more than seeing the murder she had put in play go from abstract concept to reality. "We need to ask you some questions," Joe told her, his manner blunt. She looked up at him dazed. Slowly, some intelligence filtered into her dark eyes. "You think I had something to do with this?" she said. "Ma'am, I didn't imply anything of the kind," Joe answered back with a straight face. "Of course you did," she snapped, her mouth twisting into something bitter. "You heard about our divorce and thought I could do something like this." "Mrs. Patel," I said, "this is all routine. We have to question you." She turned towards me, her eyes now fully alive. "I hated Sanjay," she told me. "He was a horrible man, cheap and mean. But it would make no sense for me to want him dead, at least not now. He stole everything we had and moved the money to his parents in Bangalore. It didn't matter to him that he was leaving me and my son penniless. My lawyer was making him give a full accounting so that the judge would make him return our money. If I were going to kill him, it would be after that. "We still need to talk with you," Jill said. "No, not now. Now I need to pick up my son. If you want to talk, you can come by my apartment later." Her eyes blazed for a moment as she stared hotly at Joe. "But if you want to talk to who killed Sanjay, talk to his parents. They're cheap like him. They would do anything to keep our money from being returned." "How much money are we talking about?" I asked. She looked back at me, almost as if she had forgotten I was there. "Over $200,000," she said, spitting out the words as if they were poison. Along with all of our savings, Sanjay took out a $93,000 second mortgage on our condo. He would have gone back home to India, except my lawyer convinced the judge to make Sanjay give up his passport. The last part was said with some vindication. I told her to give me her address, and we would talk to her later that night. Joe flashed me a look as if I was nuts, but I ignored him and had Mrs. Patel write out her home address for me. I watched as she stood up and walked out of the office, her legs shaky. Joe waited until she was out of sight before telling me we should have taken her in. I shook my head and told him she had a kid in daycare to pick up. "You buy her story?" "Enough of it," I said. Maybe not about the parents hiring a hitman from two continents away, but I think I'd like to talk to Patel's lawyer first and find out how much of what she told us was true. He mumbled something about how the Novocaine must have reached my brain, but he had the same doubts I did. Otherwise, he would have insisted we bring the wife in for further questioning. It was more than just doubt on my part. I knew if we brought her in, she'd be lawyering up before we got another word out of her. I could see it in those dark eyes of hers. This way, we'd have a chance to talk to her some more without a lawyer shutting us down. While we drove to Patel's lawyer, the ME returned a call I had made earlier. He told me the victim died from massive hemorrhaging, and that death had been pretty much instantaneous. "He was probably dead before he hit the ground," the ME added. "Just the single blow to the temple?" "Just the one." "What's the chance of being hit like that and surviving?" "With the force that was used?" "Same as Bluto's grade point average." "What?" 0.0. "Yeah, okay," I said, feeling a bit dense for not more quickly catching the Animal House reference. After all, I'd only seen the movie a dozen times. But taking Joe's cue from earlier, I blamed it on the after effects of the Novocaine. "Were you able to narrow down time of death?" He paused at that, hemming and hawing a bit, before telling me since the victim was last seen leaving his workplace at 2:30 and his body discovered at 3:18, that probably narrowed it down as well as he could. We talked for a while longer, mostly shooting the bull, but the ME had nothing more to add. Just that he was able to identify the tire iron as the murder weapon, that Patel appeared to be a healthy 32-year-old male before being fatally struck to the temple with that same tire iron, and that in his opinion, the blow was meant to kill. When I pulled up to the Parker house, I thanked him for the callback and filled Joe in on what was said, or at least what he wasn't able to piece together from listening to my end of the conversation. Patel's lawyer was waiting for us inside the Parker House lounge, as promised, sitting at the bar with a half-finished martini. A lot of other guys in suits who could also be lawyers were sitting at the bar with him, and we were able to identify him by calling his cell phone and seeing which of the suits answered. The suit that answered was an expensive one, probably a grand easy, and the guy wearing it was in his late 30s and built like a fireplug. Something made him look over his shoulder. He spotted us and, probably from our cheap suits, quickly made the connection as to who we were. He took his half-finished martini with him as he got up from the bar to meet us. "You must be the detectives who called me earlier about Sanjay," he said, introducing himself as Martin Gould, and first offering his free hand to Joe, then to me. "Why don't we grab a table back there where it's quiet, and we can talk?" We let him lead the way. Once we were seated, he drained what was left of his martini and waved a waitress over so he could order another one. Joe ordered a beer and a pub burger. The Novocaine had completely worn off at this point, and the area around my dead tooth felt achy and sore. I ordered a double scotch, and not thinking I could handle solid food, asked for a bowl of clam chowder. "It's the only chance we're going to have to eat tonight," I explained to Gould. He looked bemused at that explanation, but didn't bother to mention anything about the alcoholic drinks we'd both ordered. "Sanjay was murdered, huh?" he said, shaking his head. "So how can I help you fellas?" "We heard it was a pretty ugly divorce," Joe said. Gould nodded. "That would be an accurate way to characterize it. The wife told us herself she hated her husband. Not hard to believe. You think she could be involved?" A hard smile pulled at Gould's lips, giving him a bulldog look. "Not a chance," he said. "Why not?" Gould looked at us hesitantly for a moment before a shadow fell over his eyes. Grim-faced, he made up his mind to talk about his dead client. "Sanjay Patel was a piece of work," he said. "He bullied and terrorized his wife for the duration of their marriage, and at this point I'm sure all she wanted was to be free of him. Well, that and getting some of her money back. If you spoke with her, she must have told you about how he sent all the money they had to India. With him now dead, it's going to be near impossible for her to get any of that back. Me, I'm going to have to kiss nearly 30 grand in legal fees goodbye." The waitress returned with our drinks. Gould picked the olive out of his martini and popped it in his mouth, then lifted his glass. "Here's to clients who have the decency to pay their bills before getting bumped off," he said somewhat whimsically. "The wife told us he transferred over 200 grand," Jill said. Gould thought about it, nodded. "That sounds about right. He'd been moving their money regularly over the last 4 years, emptying out everything they had. Then before filing for divorce, he took all the equity out of their condo through a second mortgage and moved that also. Where's the money now?" "Most likely with his parents in India. Her lawyer is in the middle of a discovery motion and is trying to get an accounting of those funds." "This money transfer went on for 4 years?" I asked. "Yep. She didn't have a clue about it, though." "How's that?" He took a long sip of his martini, his eyes dulling as they lifted and met mine. He had her completely in the dark about their finances, and for the most part about everything. He isolated her from her family and used her as a workhorse to finance his new life in India. What would have been his new life if someone hadn't called her lawyer to tip him off? If that didn't happen and the courts didn't force him to surrender his passport, I'm sure he'd be back in India now. "Sounds like his wife had good reason to hate him," I said. "Sometimes hate is a stronger motivation for murder than money." He shook his head. "It's not in her. Not from what I could see. This woman's a lamb. Sanjay was the wolf." "She had some crazy idea that his parents could be behind this," Joe muttered, half under his breath. Gould thought about that, nodded. "It's not that crazy. Sanjay was cut from the same cloth as those two, and it wouldn't surprise me if they'd do something like that." "Did you speak to them?" "Once," he said. "I tried to explain to them what could happen if they refused to send back the money, but they seemed more concerned about ways they could hide the money than about their son's welfare." Joe's burger and my clam chowder were brought over. Gould asked the waitress for the check, then finished his martini and pushed himself away from the table. "Dinner's on me, detectives," he said. "Enjoy." "Thanks. Any idea who tipped off the wife's lawyer about the money transfers?" I asked. He smiled grimly. "Probably someone who didn't want to see his dirtbag client get away with stealing $200,000 and leaving an innocent woman and her 2-year-old son destitute. Any other questions? Feel free to call me any time." He left, and both Joe and I half-heartedly ate our food. It was looking like we had legitimate suspects 2 continents away, and the thought of that wasn't helping our appetites. "This is going to be a mess," Joe grumbled. I agreed with him and thought hard about ordering another double scotch, but we still had a long night ahead of us, even without trying to figure out how to get authorities in India involved. Later that night, we met again with the widow at her apartment, a small one-bedroom in Everett. She explained how her husband had left her buried in debt, and this was all she could afford. "What type of man would make his own son live like this?" she asked. I couldn't answer her. Her son looked small for his age, but had huge brown eyes that stared fixated up at Joe. Joe had never married and didn't have any kids of his own, and I couldn't help smiling seeing how this attention from a 2-year-old boy unnerved him. Mrs. Patel was also tense. her eyes moving from Joe to me like ping-pong balls. But she seemed to relax a bit when we asked for contact information for her dead husband's parents. I guess she realized we were taking her earlier suggestion seriously. We asked her some more perfunctory questions, but didn't get anything that made it look like she was involved. She was nervous because we were cops, nothing more. She gave us her dead husband's last address. Neither of them had been living in their condo. According to her, it was under foreclosure. Before the divorce, he was supposed to be paying the mortgage, she said, some wetness showing around her eyes. But he didn't. For 6 months, he didn't. Instead, the money was sent to his parents. Right after he moved out, I received the foreclosure notices. He ruined my credit so badly, I was lucky to be able to rent this apartment. I had to pay them 4 months' rent in advance to get it. What type of man would do that to his wife and child? Again, all I could do was shake my head. A cheap man, she said. She started crying then, the floodgates opening up. A cheap and horrible man. The boy started crying in sympathy. I could see Joe desperately wanting to bail, but I couldn't do that. I sat next to her and put my arm around her and felt her shrink into herself. The boy buried herself in Joe's pant leg. Joe glared daggers at me, but I ignored him and waited until Mrs. Patel stopped crying. Sanjay Patel's studio apartment in Somerville looked like the place of someone who wasn't going to be there long. Outside of a card table near the kitchen for him to eat his food on and a mattress on the floor, there was no other furniture. There wasn't much in there other than a laptop and some clothes and papers scattered about, and it took less than 15 minutes to search the place. It was at the bottom of a garbage bag that I found the magazine, in which an advertisement in the back pages had been circled. The ad was for a special type of troubleshooter who could take care of difficult problems. From the type of magazine, I expected to find a lot of ads like that, and it didn't surprise me that one of them was circled. The only contact information in the ad was for a P.O. box in Revere. I called Joe over to show him what I'd found. Son of a bitch, he said. Yeah. He was going to have his wife killed. Yeah. Backfired him. Got him killed instead. That's what it looks like. Son of a bitch. Joe stood frozen, his face reddening with anger. I missed the Bruins game for this guy? He was too mad to finish what he was going to say. We left the apartment together and found the nearest bar where we could catch the third period of the game on TV. I bought the first few rounds while Joe sat stewing. It didn't help that the Bruins lost. We staked out the UPS store where the P.O. box was located for 3 weeks before I spotted our man. The FBI had sent me a dossier on known hitmen who worked the area, and I recognized Mike Nelson as he walked into the store. He was a big man with thick arms and dead eyes. He took several steps towards his mailbox, but some sort of sixth sense must have alerted him that I was there because he turned on his heels and walked out of the place before he could open his mailbox and pick up the letter I had sent him answering his ad. I stayed where I was and gave Joe a call. He was parked outside and he had made a hitman also. He called me back 5 minutes later to tell me our guy was sitting in a bar only 3 doors down. How do you want to play this? He asked. We could continue the stakeout. But this had been going on for 3 weeks, and I didn't think Nelson would be using that P.O. box again. And I knew why he was waiting where he was. I'm going to talk to him, I said. Probably best if I do it alone. Joe didn't argue with me. He told me he'd be parked out front of the bar waiting for me. 3 doors down was a place called McGuire's. Joe was double parked out in front of it. Inside, sitting at a back table, was Mike Nelson. He stared at me with pale, dead eyes before nodding. Detective, he said, why don't you take a seat? I sat across from him. What are you drinking? He asked. He had some murky brown liquid in a shot glass in front of him. I told him scotch, and he indicated that to the bartender. I hope I didn't keep you waiting long, I said. No, not too long. How do you know I'd be watching your box? He smiled, but it was as dead as his eyes. Don't know what you're talking about, detective. If you're not going to answer any questions, then what's the point of this? He smiled again, but it remained as lifeless as before. Detective, I'm having the psychic flash that you're investigating a homicide. How does that sound? I didn't answer him. His eyes stayed locked on mine. Why don't you tell me about which murder you're investigating? He knew which one, but he wanted me to tell him, so I did. Yeah, I remember reading about that in the papers, he said. Hypothetically speaking, why would I want to kill this Patel guy, assuming I'm not the sweet and gentle guy that I am? Let's quit these games. I've seen your FBI dossier. He raised an eyebrow at that. I'm not admitting to anything, but hypothetically, if I was a hitman and I killed this Patel, you'd never find any evidence tying me to it. So, detective, you'd be wasting your time sitting here talking to me. Why wouldn't I be able to tie you to it? He made a face as if he tasted something unpleasant. If I remembered right from what I'd read in the papers, there were no surveillance cameras where this Patel was killed and no eyewitnesses. If you had any physical evidence tying me to this murder, I'm sure you'd be arresting me now instead of sitting here with me. So it seems obvious. But I'm talking hypothetically, of course, because I'm not a hitman. Just a guy sitting in a bar indulging one of Cambridge's finest. Of course he was right. We had no witnesses, no physical evidence, no money links, nothing except a circled magazine ad. And that was no longer going to do us any good unless we could find one of Nelson's fingerprints on the mailbox, which I doubted was even a possibility. My scotch was brought over. I took it in one gulp, then found myself shaking my head. Why? I heard myself asking. He looked at me confused. Why kill your client? I asked. What happened? Did Patel try to stiff you? Did he try blackmailing you into doing the murder for free? Why kill him? Nelson scratched his jaw, thinking about what I'd asked. This is all hypothetical, he said. Just stuff I'm piecing together from what I read in the papers. He stopped for a moment, probably trying to figure out how to word things so it couldn't be used as a confession. Let's say, hypothetically, I was a hitman, and someone like Patel hired me. And let's say this guy pays me everything he owes me, not without a lot of moaning about it, but he pays me. And then he tells me he wants his wife dead because of all the money he stole from her, not because he gives a rat's ass about his 2-year-old boy. That he's actually thinking of selling to a pedophile before he heads back to India so he doesn't have to be stuck taking care of him. Maybe he actually has the gall to ask me if I know anyone who might be interested. That's what he asked you? To help him sell his son to a pedophile? This is all hypothetical, Nelson stated with a stubborn insistence. Nothing more than how I'd imagined this conversation might have gone. And maybe in this imaginary, hypothetical conversation, his exact words might have been that he wanted to sell his son to someone who could make use of him. But it would be pretty damn obvious what he meant by that, wouldn't it? A wave of anger flushed Nelson's face, and he lowered his eyes and cleared his throat to better compose himself. Then those dead eyes were back on mine. Let's just say some people deserve to die, he said in a soft voice. Thank you. The words just slipped out of me. He gave me a puzzled look as if he was uncertain whether I was thanking him for answering my question or for killing Patel. To be honest, I didn't know the answer to that myself. I felt shaky as I got up from the table and walked out of the bar. I thought about what Patel asked of Nelson and doubted that Patel was really looking to sell his son to a pedophile. Maybe he didn't care if that was where his son ended up, but it probably didn't matter to him for what purpose his son was sold, whether it was to a couple who wanted a child or to be raised as a domestic servant. I was glad, though, for that misunderstanding. Without it, Nelson might not have been incensed enough to change his target. When I got in the car next to Joe, he gave me a concerned look. Jesus, you look like you saw a ghost. What happened in there? He asked. Nothing, I said. I hit a dead end, nothing more than that. I paused for a moment as I made a decision. We might as well go back to the station house and tell the captain we've run out of leads. He's not going to like it, but we're wasting our time on this. Joe grimaced, thinking about it. There's got to be something we can do, he said. I mean, come on, at least we know who the hitman is. I could have explained the simple truth that, as Nelson so eloquently put it, some people just deserve to die, but Joe was a black-and-white kind of guy. He didn't see gray areas well. I didn't bother saying anything, and we rolled back to the station house in silence.
Some People Deserve to Die is copyrighted by Dave Zelserman. Music for this podcast is from the Internet Archive's Our Media Collection. Mixing was done by Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one by visiting our website at www.themysteryplace.com/EQMM.